Thank you so much for downloading this episode of So What Do You Really Do, the podcast where I, your host, Dead Air Dennis Maller, interviews artists and entertainers about their day jobs. And before we get into today's program, real quick, I just have to tell you, there is a lot of things on the works that are going to be pretty big for So What Do You Really Do and for myself. So for those of you who are returning listeners, thank you so much for all your support over the years. If you've listened to every episode or two episodes or three or a dozen, however many, you keep coming back. Thank you so much. If this is your first time listening to the podcast, welcome. I hope you enjoy it. Thank you so much for being here. What I'm going to ask both of you, groups of people, is to please tell somebody about the podcast. Leave a comment on whatever platform you're listening to this on currently. Tell some friends about it. Tweet about it. Post it on Facebook. It's going to go a real long way to the plans that we have coming up that I can't talk about yet, but I will soon. Probably by the next episode, I'll be able to tell you what's in the works. But we have a lot of really great guests upcoming soon. So there's going to be some amazing episodes incoming. So please, for the sake of me and my guest, please review, comment, rate it on whatever platform you listen to it on, or please tell some people about it. We are really working hard. All of me and my guests work really hard at what we do, and it would be very disappointing if their efforts would not bear fruit. So that's what we're here for, is to give you all interesting stories while supporting the things that we do. So we thank you so much for your support and your continual support by telling people about the podcast, by either telling them in person, face-to-face, in real life, or leaving a comment on your favorite platform that you're listening to this podcast on, whether it be iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Pandora, whatever you listen to this on. If you leave a comment on any of the episodes, it's going to be huge for me and my guests. So now that that's over with, and can't wait to tell you about the big news soon. As much as I can't wait to tell you about today's guest is Philip Wilborn. Philip and I met through Clubhouse during the pandemic. He is just a guy who's floating around some of the same comedy rooms that I was on Clubhouse, and just by being funny and interacting and both of us having good, interesting stories. Like, he works in the entertainment business. Literally, he's in L.A. He is a regular, performer for sketches on Jimmy Fallon. Not Jimmy Fallon, Jimmy Kimmel. I always get those Jimmys mixed up. If you listen to the Wayne Fetterman episode, I did not take out the fact that I said the wrong Jimmy was the show that he wrote monologue jokes for. And you know, I'm going to leave that in too, because I'm human and I make mistakes. I try not to, but they happen. I'm not great with distinguishing between two comedians, both named Jimmy, that have late night shows. But anyway, Phil has been great. He's an amazing impressionist and a wonderful, nice human being. He works in TV. He's worked in radio, voiceover, movies, TVs. He's been an amazing talent of a person, and I was so glad to have him on the show. He has some really great, funny, interesting stories that I'm not going to wait any longer to tell you about and let you just get right into it. So please enjoy my conversation with comedian, improviser, voiceover artist, and actor, Philip Wilborn. So let's open up with the Clubhouse, because that's how we met. That's how we know each other. And I've talked to a lot of people who tried Clubhouse and just like, it's not for me, I don't like it. You know, for me, the only reason that I continue to come back is because, and what kept me in using the app was the Big Comedy Network, you know, not to suck up to them or anything, but it's really the warmth and like the companion and like the friendship and the community that they fostered and the people a part of it is what I wanted to be continuously coming back to. You know, Laugh Factory had a thing, and that really felt like the cool kids in school that didn't like anybody else, you know, like, oh, we're the good looking people. We don't need to talk to you pledges. Like,
I think we were the good looking people. I think that's the truth. I think we were the good looking people. That was the real deal. You know what was interesting about Clubhouse for me was that was at a, I got into Clubhouse February of 2021, and my manager called me. She goes, hey, there's this new thing called Clubhouse. We're doing a lot of industry meetings. You need to get on this app. You definitely need to be on this app. So I said, all right, I'll do it. And I went to a room she was in, and there were a lot of people going, oh my God, that's so great. I love that information. Could I piggyback off of that by saying headshots are so important, because headshots are the greatest way. Oh my God, can I piggyback off of that? Because I love different looks in headshots. And so like I stayed in there for about 15 minutes and I couldn't take it anymore. So I started a room called Can I Piggyback Off of That? And it literally was just an improv game of us doing piggyback room, just saying piggyback off of that. And then it turned into like, oh, could I swan dive off of that? Could I nickelback off of that? And it was just so funny. And it turned into about a 3-hour improv session that was so awesome with people around the world. And I was like, oh my God, I'm completely addicted to this thing. So, cause it was just like having your sketch community, but you know, we couldn't go anyplace. So with the innovation of that, I started meeting people on Clubhouse and I loved it. I thought it was so fun and just started developing different things. I did a lot of Trump. I would do a whole room where I would do Donald Trump and people would ask me questions and it would be crazy. And I would be, you know, I was the first one to be doing that kind of weirdness on that and on that app. There's a lot of people that do it now, but not so much now that the app is kind of waning. But yeah, for a while there was people like, oh, that's a good idea. Let's do that. So yeah, it was really fun. I loved it. And then we just started developing actual shows for it, like Impersonation Nation, which is just a tribute to impressions and people that are impressionists doing their impressions. And then we did Impression Idol, which was just American Idol, but with people doing impressions and singing. And then Bring It, Nikki Bernal came up with this idea for a game show called Bring It. That was the best. That's one of the best things I've ever done on Clubhouse. I love it. It's so fun. It's an interactive game show, making people change their PTRs from pictures they found on the web to pictures in real life. And you, Dennis, are one of the kings of this game.
Oh, keep going.
You really are. No, I mean, I do you're love always, it. Like, not, you're always not in between places. Not to,
like,
suck up to
you. Like, I love it. It's so innovative and so original. You know, you and Nikki work so great together. And I just, you know, the first time you guys did, or at least the first time I walked into the room, you know, just to be supportive of Big Comedy Network and all that stuff, and you guys and stuff that I've seen around, you know, especially I was seeing Nikki a lot more in those things than I was you until PTR. And I was just like, all right, cool, whatever. It's a game show. And then, you know, I after a couple questions, like, all right, I'll play from the audience. I really don't want to be involved. I'm on a bus. I'm on a subway coming home from trivia. And like, then I got into it. I was like, oh, you know what? This is a lot of fun. And then, you know, obviously as time progressed, I went, so I've tried to make, you know, everything. I'm trying to make the joke, not even like playing straight. It's just like, I don't even care if I win. I just want to make everyone else laugh. And I'm trying
oh
to
my
do
God.
The
and
most
you do every single time.
Answers
like,
I can
just
do.
Your ideas of, you know, like some people are in their house and they go full on, like we make people dress mm-hmm. up like things. We make people find things in their house, but you always manage to be in the ballpark of what we're looking for. Even if you're on a bus or subway, or like, I remember one time we had something about I think it was about gas prices and you were at a gas station or something. I got off the bus to get at this gas station.
I got a whole stop early just so I could run into this gas station. And also, to be honest, I do play a lot of things up just for the craziness of it. Like the, you know, the most recent one we did was, you know, barefooted face tattoo guy screaming and yelling, swinging. And
right.
There was a guy with like his shoes half off and face tattoos and kind of talking to himself. But I played that up so much bigger than it was because, you know, we heighten things in the comedy business.
You got to heighten it all. You got to heighten it all. And one thing that's really weird was like when Nikki and I would play, we don't do it as much anymore, but when Nikki and I would play it and we would do the thing in the middle where I would go find something, I literally would go do it live. So people could
love
see
that
how
bit.
To do
love
it.
Love that bit. Yes.
And
I tried to laugh on the last one when you were doing it with Mike and Stacey. I was trying to get those like, hey, can one of you guys explain how to do this round? Like, anybody?
I know. I felt like we got started so late and those guys did appreciate it. Yeah. And it was always something to try to make Nikki laugh or try to do something to annoy Nikki. So that was kind of, it kind of had its own purpose of it. It had its own moment of its own, but yeah, I loved it. It was such a fun, ridiculous bit for sure.
Yeah. And it's like, I just love that interactiveness of it, like creating stuff that, because Catherine always keeps reaching out to me and she's like, hey dude, you're funny. Do you want to do a show on here? And I'm like, I don't really have any ideas. I also don't have the time to devote to it. Like, you know, I'm hosting trivia 3 nights a week. I'm trying to get through comedy couple nights a week. I'm also working sound at comedy clubs. Was at the time, no longer. That's a good thing, by the way. Yeah. I'm no longer involved with that one club. But the I just don't have the devote. The only concept that I have is, like, I created a few years ago a trivia game because I host trivia. But it was a trivia game called, at the time, you know, Comedians in Bars Hosting Trivia. I've now since going to change the name to I Didn't Know That, which is a great Monty Python reference.
Oh, I love that.
But the right. So the basically it's trivia, bar trivia hosted by two comedians, and each round's a different style of trivia. It's like standard bar trivia, Family Feud trivia, visual round. And then, like, the fourth round, the co-host, and it's a different co-host each show, the co-host comes out and does stand up. And then your questions for that round are based on the stand up you just heard.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And then that keeps people paying attention to the comedy. It's more of a show. We give out zinger prizes. Like, you know, every, instead of just giving out answers, we have members of the audience come out and give us their answer. And we, you know, crowd work and make fun of them for their wrong answers and stuff like that. And then we give everybody a prize. Some prizes are like drink tickets. Some prizes are zonk prizes, you know, like here's a jar full of pennies, you know, just dumb shit just for the interactiveness. And I was like, I would love to bring that to Clubhouse, but it's, you know, I can't keep up with it. So anyway, that's that on that.
I'm glad to help you figure out how to do it, because I could tell you how to do it. Bring It is really interesting in the sense of, it is 11 questions. It's 11 questions. And those are I write the questions the day of or day before. Like sometimes, like this past week, I was finishing them up right before we finished, because I was actually working as well. But it's 11 questions, and you just fill in the blank. So once you get the template down of what you're doing, you know, it definitely helps. And I will say, for your show, so we did a show at the Iowa West in Hollywood called it was called Late Night Explosion. And it was a cross between Conan and the Larry Sanders Show. And it was a great show. And it was one of the most fun I've had doing live on stage shows. And I kind of played the Rip Torn character. And my buddy, okay, Doug, he played the host, but he was always kind of disheveled. He was more of a producer, but he wanted to be the host of this show. So I was kind of the glue that would kind of hold it together and lead and do stuff. But anyway, point is, he got bored with it because it was a different show every week. He would instead of doing the same show, like, he would get bored. This show is goldmine. People come to see it. And he would try to change it every single week. Different segments, different this, different that, blah, blah, blah. And so once you figure out the format of what it is, you know, just lock it in. And then if you have something special like Star Wars, you know, May the 4th or whatever, you could change something out, but lock in that format of what you want to do and then just do it every week until you get it down or get a team, and then, you know, move it from there. I'd be glad to help you with it because I think it would be awesome. And it's a great idea, especially I love the part where you bring in a comedian and you have to do stuff off listening to them and what they say.
Yeah, and the reason that came about is, like, you talk to people and they're like, oh, pub trivia people, they don't pay attention. If you do stand up there, they're not going to pay attention. I'm like, well, they have to pay attention because their questions are based on paying attention. And, of course, the show is more for comedy fans than it is, you know, trivia people. Trivia people want to come, you know, because some people get really hardcore about trivia and they're annoying. I've been blessed at all my trivia places to have, like, some of the coolest, nicest people that care more about the fun than they do winning or losing. And not to toot my own horn, but what I aim for and what people keep telling me is that the second best thing about coming to trivia is just watching you host. Like, even at some of my locations, people refuse to play every week, but they sit there and they listen. They're like, dude, you're just fun. And that's what I aim for, is fun, not trivia. So, but speaking of going on the subject of you talking about work, actually, let's go before work, because you've already talked about your impressionist. So when did you realize that you can do these impressions? Cause it's always a thing that so many people are like, oh, I'm really good at this voice. And then you hear them, you go, no, you're not good at that voice.
Well, I started doing it when I was a little kid. My dad loved watching Westerns. So, and I'd see, like, Rich Little on TV doing John Wayne and stuff like that. And we watched, like, reruns of, like, Bewitched and stuff like that. So I would like do John Wayne and Uncle Arthur, Paul Lynde, and just thought it was hilarious. And I'd be like a little kid doing these weird voices. And then when I started watching Saturday Night Live, I would try to do all the voices the people on Saturday Night Live would do. So, you know, I was trying to do all the presidents. I've always done all the presidents. I've always done, you know, different celebrity voices and stuff like that. But it was a thing that it was kind of my thing as a kid. Like, I would do that. Like, I remember when I was in seventh grade, I was obsessed with Dukes of Hazzard to the point where, like, my seventh grade yearbook only had two Roscoe in everything, because I was doing Roscoe impressions all the time because I thought it was so funny because it was the biggest show on TV at the time. So dumb.
Well, on that, like, when you realize you could do these and that you want to do these, like, you're obviously inspired by other impressionists that came before you. Like, oh, if they, like, I'm the same way when it came to entertainment and acting. Like, my friend, Ken Reed, who hosts the TV Guidance Counselor podcast, one of the questions he often asks his guests is that, when did they realize that people made TV? And every time I listen to that question, I go, I can't remember a time where I don't remember that TV was made, that it was written and acted and people created it. You know, like, maybe when I was a real little kid, I was just like, oh, Sesame Street is real. You know, like, Big Bird is a bird, not a guy in a suit. Like, maybe when I was really little, but very early age, I realized that this is all created by things. And that, and I always thought, it was like, if they can create it and get paid for it, I can too, you know? What was it? So it's very similar to your situation where you're like, hey, I'm seeing these people who are doing it. I can do that too.
I will tell you, this is a real story. When I was 3 years old, mm-hmm. I broke our television.
I knocked our TV off into the floor and the frame came off. And that became my favorite toy because I was on TV all the time. So from my, like, 3 years old, I knew I wanted to be on TV. I knew I wanted to do that stuff. So I was always doing those kind of things, you know, like, instead of doing, you know, before the pandemic, I ran into Anthony Daniels at Star Wars Land, unbelievably. And I told him, I was like, when I was a little kid, all the kids wanted to be Luke and Han, but I wanted to be C-3PO in East Texas because I could act it out and do the voice. And so, you know, so I was always doing that kind of stuff. And from the get-go, I knew I wanted to be on, you know, I've always wanted to do Saturday Night Live. I've always wanted to do sketch comedy. I've always wanted to do that kind of stuff. So, you know, it's kind of been ingrained in my body, I guess.
Yeah, that's interesting. Like, you know, you always see in media and TV as kids, like, kids, you know, turning refrigerator boxes into TVs or clubhouses or rocket ships and all that. And to be honest, my family could never afford a new refrigerator, so I never had that option as a toy. But, you know, with different similar things, I tried also as much of my imagination as I could. And it's great that, you know, we as entertainers can literally now use what we as a kid, imagination, to create the worlds that we do, especially in improv and sketch. What you're doing, like, I'm more stand up. I like that so much more. I don't mind acting, but, you know, I'm not going to do Shakespeare. You're going to get Dennis. You know, you're going to get all of Dennis in your acting, and that's really what you're going to get. You know, not too much character work.
But the thing about it is that's something people want. People don't do Shakespeare. There's not as much Shakespeare on there. There's more guys like you on there. So I wouldn't shoot yourself in the foot with that. I would be like, hey, you know, this is me. The people that can sell themselves, that's the thing that's always been my problem, is I am so generic. And but I can be all these other people. And so, but the people that are specific and are just themselves work a lot. So don't shoot yourself in the foot. Use that as an asset.
I'll counter that with, I was doing a lot of background work here in New England. And one of the problems that I had with a lot of background work is that, and I'm fine with background work. It's like, it's so easy. It's like, what, $27 an hour? You know, two free meals, all you have to do is not look at the camera and not fall down. It's very easy work and I'm okay with it. But the problem that we had, which I got a lot of feedback from casting agents, is that I'm not like you, where I'm generic looking. I'm very, like, my stance, my height, my face, you know, being shaved head, you know, just even my personal style is very unique, and it's much more suited to, you know, more supporting roles. So it's like, they have to try and find supporting roles for me, but also at the same time, let's be honest, I'm ugly. So it's like, it's hard to put me in a supporting role. You're like, when somebody looks at him, goes, ugh.
Well, first of all, that's not true. But second of all, you know, there's always going to be people, you know, there's always people that are needed. There's always people that are needed. And like, I think you're more castable than I am.
Yeah, but not for background. But not for background. That's the difference in that scenario, in my opinion, or in experience.
Yeah, but I mean, background's fine. But, you know, background is fine. Background is fine. But everybody wants to be foreground, you know, unless you're just going to be background forever. So, you know, just shoot for the stars and be a supporting person and then be nice to the background people because you can go, yeah. Hey, I was one of you at one point.
Well, on that, so what I've always wondered when it comes to like people who do impressions is, you know, like me as a comedian, I can go out and just do stand up and keep practicing, getting better at it. You know, sketch, you keep writing sketches and you just keep performing them. For an impressionist, how do you practice it? Do you have to go out in front of people? Do you record yourself? Is it mirror work like with magicians and stuff like that? How do you practice and do accurate representations of people?
Well, you know, and a lot of people do I know a lot of impressionists that are stand-ups. I'm not a big stand-up person. I can do stand-up, but I don't like being on stage by myself as much. When I was doing sketch comedy every week, we would take the people in the news and, you know, I would be doing all kinds of different people that I'd never done before or given the task of, hey, learn this impression for this show this week. And so, but it is about, like my three rules of, this is like when I do an impressions workshop, these are my three rules of doing impressions. It's who do you look like? Who do you sound like? Who do you like? If you look like somebody, the moment you walk on stage, people are going to go, oh my God, that's Brad Pitt. That's my problem. I have that problem all the time. But if you look like somebody, people are automatically going to jump to that. So you can add stuff in your vocal stuff and stuff like that with it. And people are more apt to buy it. If you sound exactly like somebody, like let's take Frank Caliendo, one of the most amazing impressionists, but he's a short, round guy. And so like when he does Kramer and stuff like that, you're like, but he sounds so much like him. You're like, okay, I got that. I got that. So if you sound exactly like somebody, then you just find all the lines and the things you need and write in that voice that you do it. And then the third one is who do you like? So let's look at, George H.W. Bush, for example. Dana Carvey was given the task of coming up with a character for George Bush. And it wasn't George Bush. It was kind of shades of George Bush. You knew what he looked like. You knew what he sounded like. You had his glasses. You knew what he said. And then you paint all that together and you come up with a character that's an impression. I did that with Sully Sullenberger. I had this somebody in my class who's writing on Family Guy right now. She wrote somebody who was in my show, Top Story Weekly. She's working on Family Guy now, and she wrote a sketch about Sully, where Captain Sully Sullenberger, instead of being the gracious, sweet, kind-hearted man he is, he was kind of pompous and arrogant about being that guy. And so he had this whole thing, like if he saw a fireman, and he goes, oh, you saved like six people from a building? That's great. But did you save 155 people's lives by crash landing a plane on the Hudson River? I don't think so. What the H, man? And he never cussed. He always just said letters. So it was so, you know, I saw this girl and he would always go to the Olive Garden for free. He was always dating like older ladies, celebrities. So it'd be like, I was at the Olive G with Delta B the other day. And it was just so stupid. It was just like dumb stuff. But it was a great character. And it came from all of those tools. So I put on a white wig and a mustache. And so people saw, and I had enough stuff painted in there of the character that people knew who I was playing. And it made this well-rounded character that our sketch show, the audience loved so much, we did it a lot. So it was kind of like our Fonzie for a little while. So it was really cool.
By the way, I always say, I always love a good Delta Burke reference. Yeah, I know she's been lost to the annals of time, but I always love a good Delta Burke reference because I grew up watching Designing Women. Oh, yeah. And I might like it because Annie Potts was my first celebrity crush. So I think any reference to what Annie Potts has been a part of always resonates home for me.
And it generally was, in all honesty, not joking, it generally was that Sully was either out with Annie Potts or Delta Burke. It was like every single time. You know, it was that, and it was always the Olive Garden. He got a free card to go to any Olive Garden he wanted to. So he was always going to the Olive Garden in Sherman Oaks.
Well, as performers, we always have to, you know, obviously figure out some way until we start making money in the art that we're doing. We have to figure out how to make money somehow and be able to do our art. You know, I always say it's like, the show is about the things we do during the day to support the things we want to do at night.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure it's very hard to do improv in the middle of the afternoon.
Right.
Like nobody at their job wants to see improv.
I always tell my friends, if you want to stay, you have to play. And that's the way it is. You know, if you're going to show up out here and say, well, I'm going to be a star in 6 months, you know, if it works out, great. But after that 6 months, you're like, all right, I have to get a job. So yeah, that's a really interesting place to be in. But I have a very unusual job.
Yeah. And that's what I was getting to is that I was wondering, I know you do TV news, or at least you used to, I'm not sure where you're at with it right now, but was that a thing that you started in Texas and took to LA?
So I always wanted to be on TV. And so when I was in college, I got a radio television degree with a interdisciplinary in theater and speech and stuff like that. And so I was never
I do want to point out, I was looking at your LinkedIn and your education says a BS in radio and television, yeah. Which we know is Bachelor of Science. But when you see BS in radio and television, I think we both know that our degrees are, because I have a radio and TV degree. We both know that our degrees are bullshit.
So. Well, I don't know about that because I got a job right out of college. So
fair enough. Yes. I also got the job in radio while I was still in college. So yes, but I think we both know as performers to see a BS in front of our job.
But I do understand that. Yeah, I was at East Texas State University, so it could not have been even more BS than that. But I will say this. But so when I got my a friend of mine was working at a TV station in a small town in Texas, and I went to an interview. They had a job there. And I went to interview, and when I went to this interview, and it was a small town, it was a little place. And at the time, electronic news gathering was what was something that was a big acronym that we would do called ENG is what it was called. And I literally went to this audition, but job interview. And said, oh, man, I am so interested in ENG. I really think my future is in television and blah, blah, blah. And I did not get that job in the least. I was like, it was bad. I was wearing a suit. I was just like, nothing. So the same guy got a job at a major market television station in Dallas. And he said, hey, there's a weather producer gig open. You know, you should come audition for this. And I was, or you should come interview for this. And I said, well, I'm not going to get this job. So I went there dressed okay, wearing a goofy like Warner Brothers or Disney tie or something like that. And I think it was actually an Aladdin tie. That's what I had on. I wore an Aladdin tie this interview because I wasn't going to get it. And I met this famous weather guy named Troy Dungan, who was like he was like a local celebrity in Texas. And so we went. I met him. And he goes, oh, I love your tie. And he had he always wore a bow tie. And he had socks with bow ties on it. And I was like, oh, those socks are great. And so I was goofy. I was being goofy, doing impressions, doing stuff like that. And then at the end of the day, they were like, you made a really good impression. And I was like, what? And so I didn't have a job. And so I asked, I said, can I just come here and learn how to do stuff? I know I'm not going to get the job, but can I just come and, you know, check stuff out a couple of days a week, kind of sort of an unofficial internship. And so they let me do that. So I think that was in February, and April 1st, many years ago, I got hired to do this job. And it was before I even got out of college. So my mom was like, please finish your degree. And so they let me finish they hired me, and I trained for 3 months. And then, and then I finished school and then went on full time. And so I was doing live TV weather, like on the news set three newscasts a day for 10 years in Dallas. And that really gave me a lot of sense of how to work production, how to be on camera, how to be around the camera and stuff like that. So when I moved out to LA, I immediately called the ABC affiliate out here, and there was there are two weather guys in LA, a guy named Johnny Mountain and a guy named Dallas Rains. And I interviewed work with a guy named Johnny Mountain, and Johnny Mountain was struggling with a radar map. He couldn't figure out how to do this. And I said, "Oh, let me do it." And I went click, click on the keyboard, and he turned to the news director and said, "When does he start?" And so I literally got that job, and then left for a little while, did radio, and then came back to Channel 7. And I work with the amazing weatherman to the stars, Dallas Rains. And he is the most excited person in the world about weather. He loves weather. He is excited about everything about weather. And when I auditioned for SNL, I literally did a character based on Dallas named Houston Storms. And I wasn't working with Dallas at the time. I was working with Johnny Mountain. And so my last day there, when I first left the TV station before I came back, I told Dallas that I had done that. You know, I'm sitting there on the home base in 8H at 30 Rock doing, "I'm 11. So it was hilarious. And so he loved it. And so to the point when I started working with him in the afternoons in the last 6 or 7 years, I would call the makeup artist. When the makeup artist would call to have Dallas do his makeup, I'd go, "Hey, Bobby, it's me, Dallas." And she'd go, "I'm ready for you." "All right, I'll be right there." And then she would get so mad because she couldn't tell whether it was me or Dallas doing the voices. So, but yeah, TV has been really good to me, and I've been doing it through the pandemic, and I still work from home. I think we're going to start going back pretty soon, but I still work from home doing the weather. So it's really crazy.
Was there a big, was it a big transition for you to try and work from home, or you're like, "Hey, I'm good at tech. I'm good at this stuff. This is an easy peasy situation."
The biggest thing that we had issue with was trying to figure out when the weather people were doing it from their house. So like I would have to do a lot of work with them to like one girl happened to be pregnant. So the whole team from engineering went out there, and she had a big room in her house, and they literally made her a green screen and lit it and everything like that. And so like to this day, she is still on at home, but it doesn't look like it at all. It looks like it literally looks like she's in the studio. You can't even tell.
That's great.
She's the girl that a few months ago, her son walked into the chroma key while she was trying to do the weather, and it went viral. It went mega viral. So Leslie Lopez, but when Dallas Rains was doing it, they were doing it where he'd have he would just use his TV in his living room with the logo in it. Okay. And then they would cut to the weather graphics full screen. And he hated that. He likes to be involved in the graphics and the stuff. And he really wants to be, you know, in there with it. And so he hated it. But my end was really simple, because all I did was I had an actual mirror of what the computer was. So it's like I'm sitting in the weather center and I'm doing everything I would be doing at home, at work at home. So it's really weird. Like I can even control the live TV from my living room, which is so weird.
Oh, there is, when I was in radio, I did a lot of time as an engineer doing like remote broadcasts, studio emergencies, you know, off-air emergencies, stuff like that, studio builds. And years ago, before I moved here to Boston 9 years ago. When I was in Baltimore in DC, I could actually run all of our stations from my iPhone. Now think about how the condition that iPhones were in 10, 12 years ago. And I could run all of our stations from that device because they had the technology put in. And now we're just so far advanced of that. And it blows my mind during this pandemic, how many stations, radio, TV were completely technologically unprepared for this. Like my friends back at the big, huge rock station in Baltimore, I don't know why I'm being coy. There's only one rock station in Baltimore. It's 98 Rock. And they'll agree with me that during the year and a half that they had to do the morning show from home, there was nonstop tech issues almost every day for them. And it's like, How have your, this, none of this fault is on Justin or Scott or Spiegel. All of this fault comes strictly on their engineering stuff. It's like, how are you a year and a half into this and you're still having the same problems you were having when all this started? Blows my mind. But I will also say that I do love the all the names that we just said. I do love those punny broadcaster names. It's great. Like, I worked mostly in traffic for on-air stuff. That's what it brought me up here to Boston. But in D.C., our head of traffic down in D.C., every different station he was on, he'd have a different name based on the format. And the only one I can remember off the top of my head is for the country stations. Ron Balseric was his real name, but on the country station, he was Wes Montana.
Nice.
And I love that.
Well, here's the thing here's the thing that's going to blow your mind. The weather people I work with, Dallas Rains and Johnny Mountain, those are their real names. Those are absolutely real names.
Yeah. Oh, I believe it, because sometimes you just have that great name and it almost is serendipitous that you go into that field.
My favorite thing about Johnny Mountain was, I don't know how big a 30 Rock fan you were, but, when Jack Donaghy's girlfriend Avery was kidnapped by North Korea, they made them do, a propaganda news network. And so it'd be Avery, and another reporter on the news desk, and then they would throw to weather, and it was Kim Jong Il doing it, but it was Margaret Cho, but they supered him as Johnny Mountain. And here's Johnny Mountain with the weather. And it made me laugh so hard. And they did that joke like three times. And I was like, who is this joke even for? Like,
that's one of the best things is like when there's just like, I love that small little like joke that's just for somebody, just for maybe one person, maybe two people. I love those jokes like that.
Like that show, The Mayor, right now, somebody posted a video from that show this past week, and they were making fun of the mall in Glendale on that show. And they were like, I just mentioned Americana at Brands. They're gonna roast me over at the Grove. And like, that was like stuff they were saying on the show. And I was like, who gets this? Who gets this? It's like when I used to watch King of the Hill. I loved King of the Hill, but King of the Hill was so real to life to me that I was like, how are people getting this? Because I get this because I'm from East Texas, but how does somebody in, California or New York get King of the Hill?
Or Montana.
Because it's so real.
Or Alaska. Yeah, anywhere. Mike Judge is brilliant, and he brings so much of his own life into his characters, his animated characters, and even on his characters in the movies. He brings so much of himself and his experience in there that it's so inspiring to watch what he does.
Yeah, right before the pandemic, I was supposed to do a short film with his daughter.
Ooh.
And it literally, I met her the week everything shut down to have a sit down. And we talked about her dad. And I got my agent in LA by writing a spec script for King of the Hill and performing it live where I did all the guys.
Oh, nice.
And that was how I got my first, agent in LA by doing that ridiculous bit, but it was killer and people loved it. And so, so that was how I got my first agent in LA by doing all of my King of the Hill voices.
Oh, Hank, you're so good.
You know, the only reason they hired you because they thought you were an alien.
Oh, that is such a spot on Dale. I love it. And we're going to come back. I want to ask you a question about agents and managers. But before that, I'm curious, since you're working in like a TV studio, prior to the pandemic, did you find working there helped your job becoming more of a voiceover artist or an actor because you were in an area of a building that had all the equipment you need to record a voiceover, to record a self-tape? To be able to connect with people like me working at a radio studio before I built my home studio, I was so fortunate to be able to walk into a studio, open a phone line, call a guest and record that conversation to be used for a podcast, to be used for my interview sections of Dig Boston and stuff like that. I was very fortunate before I built this nice studio with spare parts that I stole from the radio studios. But
right.
I found myself so fortunate being in those areas. Were you able to help advance your career by taking advantage of the location of where you're working in?
You know what? I will say this in reality. It was a great lesson to me in so many ways. like way to relate to people that work. You saw how the people that were jerks to the crew, how they were perceived by the crew when you are the crew. I also felt like that the like I have a very breaking news form of comedy. So like a lot of my videos that I produced that went viral were things that I saw in the afternoon and produced overnight. Like there's a video, it's a parody of Shallow and it's Trump and Kim Jong-un. And we shot it literally 36 hours after the Oscar, and it is shot for shot the Bradley Cooper, Lady Gaga video at a theater. It looks amazing. It's all done in one shot. I got one of the photogs from Channel 7 to come over and shoot it for me. And it, there's no edits in it whatsoever. And it is a great example of something that happened. Something and like the thing that was so weird about it is like a friend of mine is a producer for like Katy Perry and different things like that. So he helped us record the song and made sure we sounded good. And so it sounds amazing, but it's like, and the guy that did Kim Jong-un is a fantastic singer. His name's Brent Pope. And Brent is a very great comedian, but he's also a really good singer. So instead of doing a ridiculous Kim Jong-un voice, he just sang beautifully. And the people just loved it. They were like, what is this? So I was just bad as Trump in Trump voice, but it was just amazing. And it was fun. But yeah, that was my thing, is I always have a breaking news mentality as far as that goes. And that's why I hated radio, because I didn't feel like radio, like the radio that I worked in, I worked for the Premier Radio Network doing,
Well, there's the problem
for the morning shows. And so, so I was part of that world. And like I remember when Tom and Katie had Surrey, I said, oh, we should record something right now so you have it in the morning. Oh, we'll record that tomorrow. We've already done everything for today. And I'm like, what?
Right.
Let's just record something. And they were like, nah, we'll do it tomorrow.
Yeah, I feel like that's more the that problem is more of the oligarchy, whatever that word is that I'm looking, that is the radio industry. That's why it's dying, which I'm so saddened about, because I will tell you, like on that same thing of the like Trump and Kim Jong-un thing, my one of the morning shows I produced for in Baltimore on Z104.3, Jackson Blue, shout out. He's done so much for me. He calls me up and like, I'm working overnight into his morning show. That was my shift, was coming at like 11, work through. We're coming like 1 a.m. and work through until 10 a.m. at the end of the show. And he called me at like 3:30 in the morning. He's like, hey, did you watch the Charlie Sheen interview last night? I want to create a parody song using the quotes from that. Get working on that. I'm on my way. I'll be there early. I'll be there in like 30 minutes, you know, an hour earlier than normal, just so we can bang this out. And I was like, great. Quickly looked up the interview, started writing things down, started trying to create some lyrics from that. And we were talking like on the phone as he was driving, like, let's do like, Journey song or Don't Stop Believing or something like that. It's like, all right. So we looked up the Glee version. So we basically made this Glee parody version of Charlie Sheen's quotes. And it's just something we did so fast and so quick. And I was like, this is best day. This was literally the best day of my entire life as radio was this morning. We did this thing. And the only thing that I wish is that we had more time to accurately produce it and more of a team. That was one of the things that we always had problems with, is that we didn't have a support team. It was just me and him. And when I wasn't there, it was another guy. And it was just the three of us, only two at a time, working on these things. And then, of course, like the day after that, like either that afternoon or the day after we did all that, having my best day in radio, I got fired from the restaurant I worked at. So I was super sad. But, you know, everything good comes with tenfold bad in my life.
Absolutely. Well, that's the way it is for everybody. I will tell you this. This is an interesting one. So, like, there was a... I always made reactionary videos. So like when I'm imitating him. Rick Perry. When Rick Perry said, there's three things that I'm going to do. One is this, and the other thing. And so I called my friend who helped me write stuff. I said, just start writing. I'm working on hair and a wig to do this. We're going to do this tonight. He said, what am I doing? I said, it doesn't matter. Just come up with three things. And the third one you can't think of. And so it was like, there are three Brady girls. There's Cindy and Jan and the other one. So we did a video like that, and it went viral. But the best one I ever did was we did one that was this was like insane in the reactionary time period of it. At noon, I saw a story, noon or one, I saw a story that said Sesame Street has layoffs on TMZ. So I was like, all right, this is a good idea. I'd bought a Kermit puppet for a show. And so I said, I got the Kermit puppet. I glued a piece of paper to his hand like he was reading, and then put glasses on him where it looked like he was actually having reading glasses on and stuff like that. It was so stupid. And he was answering questions about it. So I put the thing on and I put the puppet on and I put it up and I was like, shoot, I'm doing this in front of a green screen. And I said, you know what? I'm just going to improvise it. If it works, it works. If it doesn't, I'll go to work. So I did it and I left blanks. Like, it was completely improvised. Like, does anybody have any questions? And then I left a pause, and then I answered a question about same-sex marriage for Bert and Ernie, and I answered another thing about something from Grover, and then the last one was, how many jobs are going to be laid off? Will there be one job, two jobs? And so that was the whole thing, and then he went, and walked off. So anyway, so I quickly threw that together. I quickly threw it together, edited it. I had CNN graphics that I used from a debate, threw that on there, wrote Sesame Street layoffs on it, did the three voiceovers for the other Muppets, uploaded it to YouTube, and then grabbed the URL off YouTube, stuck it in my phone, and on the way home, I emailed Jeannie Moss from CNN and said, hey, I saw this story today. If you want to use this, you can. By the time I got to work at 2 o'clock, it was on CNN on Situation Room in less than 4 hours.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was insane.
See, and that's, I think, the difference between, like, why I was attracted to radio, because to me, it brought my two loves together, which was music and comedy. And when I would go on air, my rule was everything I say has to be one of two things. It has to be either a joke or it has to be informative. It has to be something about the artist, something about the news and stuff and going on that. And the reason I think I was drawn to radio is because it was a medium where you had to be both tech and talent. And growing up, not having people who are interested in doing the things that I was doing, you know, performing and recording things and all this stuff, and not having the resources because, you know, poor lower middle class family from Baltimore County. We didn't have a lot of money. We couldn't buy in the 80s and 90s. You grew up in the 50s, you know, which, by the way, when you told me you dropped the TV in 1955, something like that, I'm like, oh, great. Then you're never going to have another TV for 20 years because they're so expensive. But same thing, like trying to get camcorder or any type of camera to record something in the 90s was impossible when you're a poor family trying, you know, two parents working four jobs, trying to keep your kids in school and stuff like that. So I had to make do so much with what I could. And I just found out that, you know, radio was to me a one man format. Like, that was the creative platform for, you know, starting out for all the people who would go out to be bigger. And you sound more like a collaborator. And that's, I think, what TV is. So many more people, so many moving parts. And you sound like you grew up more as someone who was easily drawn to collaborating, working with people. And I think that's the difference between our two, histories of getting into the arts and stuff.
Well, I will say, in all honesty, there's a little bit of both, because a lot of times I collaborate with people very well, but a lot of times I'm like, if nobody wants to do it, I can just do it. I'm very much about, you know, let's just get it done. And I also am not as precious about it, because we have a saying in TV is it's on its way to Mars now. Nobody cares. So people can go, oh, that newscast was so horrible. But really and truly, in the grand scheme of things, there's so many bloopers on TV. Nobody cares.
And that took me a long time to learn myself. And now I'm so happy that I'm not such a perfectionist that I dwell and obsess over the product that has been made. Or if there was a mistake that was somehow made that I don't have to stress over, it's like, hey, mistakes happen. hey, people goof up, stuff like that. And I would look at what really made me that way was I'd look at the people who would get so upset because a mistake was made. I'm like, hey, A, no one else is probably going to notice the mistake. Two, if they do, it's done and over with. It's happened. And I've been so much happier.
There is an asshole in LA. And I will say he's an asshole 100%. And I hope he hears this. he has a Twitter feed that is dedicated to Channel 7 errors. And so like he has no clue what goes into making any graphics or anything like that. Like we get all of our graphics I'll get all my graphics at 2:30. And then I have to have them on by 3:30 because the latest run of the weather comes out. And always there are at least two eyes on, we do 5 7-day. And every 7-day has an icon, two lines of text, two temperatures, and maybe a holiday icon or a wind icon. So you do that, you do 5 7 times. You do 5 7 times, and then you do that 7 times 5 times. So it's insane.
Oh, jeez. That's my head is, I'm good at math, and my head is spinning from that math.
So occasionally you'll say something like, you'll leave a word off. Yeah. So you'll misspell something, or you'll add an N to Sunny, to Sunny real quick when you're like cutting and pasting, or you'll do something quickly. And this guy relishes in putting up the mistakes online. He loves it. And I was really bad for a while. And what ended up happening was I found out my eyesight was really bad, and I got contacts, and my errors went down about 90%. So when I ended up getting contacts, it made everything so much better because I could read things. But so anyway, my point is, people love that. People love that stuff, but nobody gives a shit about it, really and truly. But there are assholes everywhere that relish it for sure.
By the way, I love that I've always said, don't take the gift of perfect vision for granted. And I know now that you definitely are on that camp. It was like, hey, if I had perfect vision, I wouldn't have made all these mistakes. Hey, I can see now. Oh, great. I'm better at my job now that I can see.
Well, one thing that got me more so than anything else was when I was doing sketch, I would have to wear reading glasses. So I would like take off. I would like, if you watch Kimmel's behind the scenes this week, when Kimmel was on Fallon and Fallon was on Kimmel, when they did thank you notes, Kimmel had to pull out his reading glasses because he couldn't read the words. And he was like, can you make these a little bigger for me so I can actually read them? And so anyway, so I would bigger, but still I'd need glasses. And so a few years ago, I went to an eye doctor and said, is there any way I can get like a reading contact? And they said, well, your left eye needs this. We could put the reading in your right eye, or your left contact. I was like, great. And so now I look like $1 million because I can read the last line on an aspirin bottle. So it's hilarious. So if my contacts are out, all bets are off. I'm wearing Coke, Charles Nelson Reilly giant glasses. But if I banned, and then when I read it, I go, what's in this aspirin? Hello.
Do you have to close the one eye since the reading glasses is in your one eye?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, it's like I have supervision. It's amazing. So I will never not wear contacts.
I know they did like bifocal contacts, where it's like, if you look down at the bottom of the contact, it's a reading lens. If you look up in the middle and higher, it's a regular thing, but I don't do contacts. I can't touch my eye.
Right. Mine, I don't need anything. I barely need anything for distance. So I just have a one in my right eye to kind of balance out, and the other one in my left eye is, I'm kind of like the Terminator. I can see forever now. So
talking to you about voiceover work, because obviously being an impersonator and being comedic, it's going to end up leading you to voiceover, one would assume.
Right.
A lot of people try to get in voiceover, and what I hear from so many voiceover artists in interviews and ones that I know, like, I worked with during the pandemic, I worked with Rob Paulson and his son, Ash, with doing Zoom things, during the pandemic. And we have yet to get to hang out in person and see the three of us face to face because I mean, and that's a huge deal for me because I'm a huge fan of Rob Paulsen. It's not like, oh, I heard of this guy. No. Like when they asked, when Flappers asked me to come, you know, work with them on their Zoom show, I was just like, yes. I mean, yes, I would. Sure, if you need me. But, you know, the 13-year-old boy in time was like, it's freaking Pinky and the Brain. It's freaking Donatello. Exactly. Right. So hearing from him over and over and so many other voiceover artists, they all say, get into regular acting first. Then if voiceover presents itself, that's the best way to get into it, is just go to acting. So is that what led you into voiceover? Was your already experience with acting, or was it the impressions that you got you there?
Well, like my voiceover stuff, when I first started, I got real lucky because my first gig in voiceover was as one of the most hated characters in all of Dragon Ball Z. I was Android 19 on Dragon Ball Z, and he's so hated. It's a really fun thing to have on your belt. And then I did some stuff for that company, Funimation. I was, Zenigata in Lupin. And then a lot of the big characters were already taken. So I would just go in because I was so versatile, and they would say, oh, there's somebody over there. There's a shopkeep. And I'd go, oh, that looks a little bit like Jonathan Winters. And then I'd do like a weird Jonathan Winters type of voice for that character on Dragon Ball Z. Or whatever, you know, I did a bunch of those kind of things, days like that. You know, they would have me come in and do some characters, and then I'd do a bunch of sub characters. But in LA, the majority of the stuff I did was from Conan, for Kimmel, and for Corden. Those were the things where I fell into it more so. And that's because I knew some of the writers and some of the producers and some of the people like that. So that helped. But what I find in LA, it's real hard to break into voiceover, period, because you have, you know, your Paulsons, your Phil Lamars, your
Maurice Lamar,
you know, John DiMaggio's, all those people, you know, those guys all are ahead of you, you know, Hank Azaria. So, you know, you're just waiting for to get into a project that you can do. But I do voiceover auditions all the time, and I'm like, oh yes, this is going to be great. And then, you know, you never hear anything. But, you know, I think it's just a numbers game. You know, one day it's going to hit. So the good thing is I still have, you know, I have all these voiceover gigs for Kimmel and Conan and stuff like that, where they'll say, hey, can you do this impression? Or, hey, can you do this? One time I had to impersonate, I think it was Animal from the Muppets, and I'd already driven to work. And they were like, can you do it? And I said, well, I've already left. And they were like, well, could you do it for us? And I was like, because I'd already done Kermit. I'd already done Ernie. I'd already done a couple of other characters on the Muppets, Grover. And so I said, well, I tell you what, I'll record it in my car. And if I get it, I'll go home and record it for real. So I literally recorded it in my car on my iPhone. No mic, no nothing. And then they called me and said, well, it's between you and Jimmy's brother. And then in the end, they said, okay, you got it. I said, all right, I'll run home. And they were like, oh no, we're using that. I was like, so the one I book is the one I just recorded in my car in the parking lot at work. So it's so weird. So you never know, but I'm very lucky in the sense that I get to do those a lot. I get to call, you know, they'll send me a clip of somebody and I'll just redo their voice. And that's generally what Kimmel is. Like a lot of the actors that are on Kimmel are people that look like characters from a viral video or something like that, you know, but for voices, it's generally like some taped bit. They want to put some new voice over. So I'll do Trump for them. Like I'm one of the few people that have done an actual Trump on camera for them, other than a back or something like that. They have a production guy that's about his height, about his body type. And he does Trump for them all the time. Like when he's naked and stuff like that, they just get him to do it. So thank God they don't call me for that.
I remember very similar on the, like the auditioning process. Like there was they didn't tell me it was a Super Bowl commercial. I ended up finding out while watching the Super Bowl. I got asked to come in, like not open call, just like, hey, we want you to come audition for this commercial. And we need somebody to do a Boston accent. And I'm not an accent guy. I don't want to do a Boston accent. But they asked me, they wanted somebody funny that was more important. So I come in. And I do a terrible Boston accent. I riff around. I do jokes. I made the casting directors laugh so hard. They're like, we don't know what you're talking about. It's just funny, Dennis. we'll let you know. We'll get back to you. And I said to them, like, I don't know why we're putting up this charade of having me audition. We both know we're going to give this role to Tony V, who is like the longtime standing Boston comedian. Like he did the, you know, the John Cusack, you know, the summer movie with John Cusack, Demi Moore. He's basically like the number one. Him and Lenny Clark are the two biggest Boston comedians who get acting roles when they film here in New England. I'm like, you're just going to give it to Tony V anyway. And never hear back from it. 2 months, 3 months later, watching the Super Bowl, this commercial starts up and I'm like, I know this commercial. I auditioned for this. And there is Tony V in the commercial doing the role that I did. And I'm like, I knew it. Oh man, I could have been in a Super Bowl commercial. And I'm glad you brought up Dragon Ball Z, because I was always curious about the anime thing, because with your experience of it, because when you listen, like Steve Bloom, who did the voice of Wolverine in the X-Men animated series from the 90s, that he would talk about, that's how he got into the business, was like this unregulated, you know, ununion anime work. And you hear a lot of stories of voiceover artists who started in anime and it sounded like it was just terrible, low pay, bad conditions, stuff like that. Maybe this was all before SAG really got into it, but was that your experience working in anime early in your career, where it's just like a slog and really tough to deal with?
Well, I think it was, but it wasn't, because we didn't know anything. We were not bright. You know, I was just a kid, you know, right out of college, and we'd get paid an hourly rate that was like double what I was getting paid at the TV station, which was nothing compared if it was a real voiceover audition. You know, I think we started off at like $35 an hour, which is, you know, when you're just a dork, you think, oh man, this is great, but you don't know what's happening. But I'll never forget all of the anime guys, like, went on strike, sort of, and they were like, we're not doing this video unless you pay us for it. And so they all negotiated that we all get paid such and such money. If you want this video game, you're going to give us this much money. And it was a pretty good sum of money. It wasn't a huge sum of money, but it was like rent for the month. And like $1,500 or something like that. I remember something in that world. And you had to get us there. That was what their other thing. They said, you have to get us there and you have to pay us this money and then we'll do this video. You know, whoever was out of town, stuff like that. So that was a thing. And so Goku and Vegeta and all these people did days and days and days of stuff. And then my character, Android 19, was so hated. He was always on all the video games, but he was like a hidden character. So I would go in there and I would go,
you are not the human we seek. I will identify him. You'll never catch me. I will steal all your energy.
Okay, thanks. See y'all next time. That would be it. That would literally be it. I'd be there 15 minutes and I'd go, is there anything else I can do since I'm here? Nope. You're all good. Thanks. Okay. I'm going to go see my mom now. So that happened once that they flew me in. And the next time they did a game that I was involved in, they did it. They didn't spring first flying me in. They got a studio out here. But that was the one where I met Norm MacDonald. So, you know, it worked out. But, yeah, same deal. Very, very short amount of stuff. Not a lot of lines, and I was finished. So.
Oh man, now I'm dying to hear Norm MacDonald do a character in Pokemon where it's like, Pikachu here, you hit the electricity and everything.
Anyway. Yeah. Hey, want these Dragon Balls? Yeah.
And the final question I'll ask you is, because this is a medium that I'm going to have zero to no experience with personally. So I'm curious about those who are on it. And I assume you're doing well because, well, at least on it, is Cameo. So obviously, no, I don't.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I could go like, hey, get a funny video from me. Nobody. Yeah. I was on the background of a Castle Rock show where you can see my ear. So yeah, it's the, what is a Cameo? How did you, like, you talked about how your agent led you into, Clubhouse. Was that a similar situation getting a Cameo? Was it something you heard about and you're like, let me check this avenue? And what's, there's a couple other versions of Cameo, different competitors out there. What made you decide on that platform as opposed to the others? And what has been your experience with getting into it?
Well, I'm on some of the others as well, but Cameo came to me and asked me to do it, as the other ones did. They all came to me and asked me. And but Cameo was the first. And I believe somebody I was working with mentioned that I did Trump. And so Cameo, one of the heads at Cameo reached out to me and asked me if I would do it. And so I was like, yeah, let's do it. And so I signed up. I did the stuff, and I started doing a few. And in the beginning, it was like, it was before Trump had become the president at the time, I believe, was when I started doing it. And or maybe he'd shortly became the president. But anyway, point is, it was steady in the sense of you'd do a couple a week or something like that. But it was not something that was, you know, I used to look at it as if it was my, like I had a personal trainer, and I said, all right, Cameo will pay for my personal trainer. And so, so I was like, all right, that'll be that. Well, lo and behold, when the pandemic hit, I started getting them all the time. Like, there was one day I got 27 in a day. Trump request. And it was insane. And so, like, during the pandemic, I did a lot. I was doing them every single day of the week. It was crazy. And so it is died down now, but I still do them regularly, you know, at least a few a week. But it is the strangest gig I've ever done. And, you know, if you have a very specific, you know, if you are a character or you are a personality that can sustain that kind of thing, I would tell everybody to jump on it because it's great. And the thing for me that's annoying is, like, if I was like Dave Foley's on there as well, and brilliant. But like I watched one of Dave Foley, and he was at an airport, and he was like, hey, just got this Cameo. Your birthday's tomorrow. I'm going to be out of town, but I just want to say happy birthday, blah, blah, blah. And so I can't do that because when I do it, I fully dress up like Trump. I completely, you know, I do like 4 minutes of Trump and at least between 3 and 4 minutes. Let's put it that way. And so people get their money's worth when they get a Cameo from me. But yeah, it's really fascinating. It's a fascinating side hustle for sure.
And I know I said that was going to be a final question, but this is the last one because I know a lot of artists do listen to this, or aspiring artists and things. And this is a question that's always so tough to answer. And you had mentioned you had manager, you mentioned that you have representation, and I'm always very curious about the people who have that. And obviously it's a very pedestrian question of like, how did you get an agent or manager? But I'm more curious is, what was your experience with getting them? Because usually you'll hear somebody will get one, their first one, and it'll always be a terrible experience. And then they'll have to get another one and find that right one and realize that, hey, I need to advocate for myself and I need somebody who's going to advocate for me. And this guy or gal or person is just not it. And they'll find the one they love, or very few percentage find the one that is their match for the rest of their career. Was your experience when first getting agents and managers a positive experience, or did you have a negative experience?
You know what? I've had all experiences because, you know, you go through different people and stuff like that. Sometimes things don't work out. Sometimes they're like, you know, there was a period of time when, you know, where it just wasn't clicking and I wasn't clicking with the person. And so we parted ways and stuff like that. So it's always a thing of like, you know, not sure, you know, it's always a thing of like just time period. And it always kind of takes time. Like one time I had the perfect manager. I really liked her a lot, but she was having a real trouble because of, different things in the world and different casting options and stuff like that. Diversity, you know, the white guy wasn't getting a lot of work. And she said, I feel like I can't get you any work. So, you know, we just need to part ways and I'm changing stuff. So, you know, it's all the things but you don't want to have somebody that doesn't believe in you or lies to you. That's one thing I've had before as well. And that's not good. That's not good. But right now I have all the best folks working for me right now. I'm with a company called Vox for voiceover, and they're the top of the heap. Really great. And I love working with them. My manager at Centera, Jess, is a person who like is very much hands-on with my career and is jokey and is very much like I've never had an agent or a manager go to your headshot session and make sure you're getting what you want. And she did. And I was like, oh my God, this is great. So I'm very lucky in that sense. But, you know, an agent is part of the job. The whole thing is your career. Like I have been in a position where I was like, well, I'm now waiting for work now that I've got an agent. And that's just not how it works. You got to get out there. You got to meet people. You got to try to do your own things, and you got to try to work and do other things that make you vocal and make you, out there, whether it's social media, Clubhouse, anything. They can't sell something. And if you're not doing something, and I always say it's like people that were in the Groundlings program, which is one of the best improv training ever. But if you just do the Groundlings classes and you don't do anything between, it's like you're acting in a closet, because you can say you have Groundlings, but what are you doing? What are you out there performing in? What area are you with? And so, you know, it's a weird deal. It really is. And it's a strange time, but you know what? You gotta take care of yourself, because if you think it's going to be a situation where you're in charge, that's not going to happen. So I hope that answers it.
No, that does. I mean, I wanted to hear people's personal experiences with things, and that's what I tried to get them to talk about.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is in your own hands. If you think you have an agent and that's the end of it, that's not it. You know, until you're, even when you're booking shows, even when you have your own TV show, you still got to look ahead. You still got to try to figure out what the next level is. So, you know.
Excellent. Well, I appreciate you being so gracious with your time dealing with all the tech issues that we had. Hopefully when we can figure out better tech working, we can do a word of the day together, because I've been wanting to get, like, Ryan Kilbourne came on and did, you know, exactly what I wanted. When we do the sentence of the day, he did it in a voice, and I would love to have you do it in a character voice when we can make sure we get everything working properly. But again, awesome. So gracious of your time, Phil. I'm glad we were able to get
this. Oh my gosh, together. I would have done it anyway. I'm so glad that we actually got to work it out, and I'm sorry that we didn't get to do all the bells and whistles that, you know, that we're trying to. I never have trouble doing stuff on my phone. And that's so weird. And I just plug in the Rodecaster directly. And then when I had trouble with that, I tried it on my computer, and my Ewan got us both Canon cameras, but we have not done we have our podcast that we're going to do called Watch It or Not, but we haven't done any in a while. And so I had turned the camera off. And so when I turned the camera back on, it wouldn't connect back to the computer. So I was like, I don't know what's happening. So anyway, yeah. it was just a comedy of errors. But anyway, next time we'll be more set to go and all that jazz. So I apologize for that.
No, do not apologize at all. Like, the conversation, what's more important. And that's what the people, I assume, listen to my podcast for, because I don't think anyone's coming here to hear me and my voice that sounds like a truck full of screaming babies crashing into a nitroglycerin factory. But they're here for the interesting people that I bring on.
We're getting sick of living in a
Once again, thank you so much for listening to this episode of So What Do You Really Do? Before you get out of the app, I ask that you just leave a review on how much you liked the podcast. It'd go a long way to supporting me and all of my guests. And of course, if you want more Dead Air Dennis, you can check out my other podcast, Word of the Day with Comedians, where a comedian and I get together, we pick a word, and come up with the most absurd, craziest, funniest sentence we can using that new word in context. It's the funniest way to expand your vocabulary and is available on iTunes, Spotify, and as a video podcast on YouTube.